Well, have a great week.
This is VOA News via remote. I'm Diane Roberts. The first World Cup in the Middle East began with a flashy opening ceremony, complete with fireworks. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma has our story.
Fireworks from the opening ceremony light up the sky above the El Bayt Stadium as the opening match between Qatar and Ecuador begins without any beer for sale in the stadium. The beer ban, imposed 2 days before the start of the tournament, was the latest controversial snag for the global event. Over 1 million visitors are arriving this week to the tiny nation on the Arabian Peninsula. Qatar is the home to 3 million people, most of them migrant workers, and has spent more than $200 billion for improvements for the games. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Qatar's first ever World Cup match ended in dismay and with a place in unwanted soccer history. The controversy-laced tournament opened with Qatar getting outplayed in a 2-0 loss to Ecuador in front of 67,000 fans. The host team had never lost its opening game in 92 years of soccer's biggest event. Negotiators have approved an historic deal to create a fund for compensating poor nations that are victims of extreme weather, worsened by rich countries' carbon pollution. The decision establishes a fund for what negotiators call loss and damage. In comments at COP27's closing session, a climate representative from Antigua and Barbuda says poorer nations have achieved victory.
Establishing this fund signals to the world that loss and damage will no longer solely be borne by those governments and people least responsible. Today is a step towards climate justice.
However, there is little progress in addressing the root cause of climate change, the burning of fossil fuels. This is VOA News. The UN's atomic watchdog chief on Sunday denounced targeted strikes at Ukraine's Russian-controlled Zaporizhia nuclear plant, calling for a, quote, stop to this madness, end quote, as Kyiv and Moscow traded blame. Rafael Mariano Grossi, the IAEA director general, said several powerful blasts shook the Russian-controlled plant Sunday, damaging buildings, systems, and equipment at the plant. A makeshift memorial of flowers, flags, and candles grew Sunday outside of a nightclub in the U.S. state of Colorado, where authorities say a 22-year-old gunman opened fire late Saturday, killing five people and leaving 25 injured. The Colorado Springs police chief laid out how patrons subdued the suspect.
While the suspect was inside of the club, at least two heroic people inside the club confronted and fought with the suspect and were able to stop the suspect from continuing to kill and harm others. We owe them a great debt of thanks.
The attack is being investigated to see if it should be prosecuted as a hate crime, according to officials, who added charges against the suspect, quote, will likely include first-degree murder, end quote. Investigators were still determining a motive. In a statement, the club called the shooting a hate attack. Iran has arrested two prominent actors who expressed solidarity with the protest movement and removed their headscarves in public in an apparent act of defiance against the regime, state media reported Sunday. This as activists on Sunday expressed alarm that Iran was implementing a major crackdown in a Kurdish-populated town that has seen intense anti-regime protest in the last few days. Iran's clerical leadership has been shaken by more than 2 months of protests, sparked by the death in custody of Mahsa Amini. The 22-year-old woman of Kurdish origin had been arrested by Tehran's morality police. Parts of western New York State are finally catching a break after a storm dumped snow for days on cities and towns. Many businesses in the hardest hit areas remained closed Sunday, but highways reopened and travel bans in many areas were lifted. For the first time in history, a sitting U.S. president turned 80 years old in the White House. Sunday, Joe Biden had a birthday but did not celebrate in any public way. First Lady Jill Biden posted an affectionate message mid-afternoon with two photos of the couple dancing. It was the sole mention from the White House of the birthday. Mr. Biden does have an important matter to discuss with his family in the coming days, whether he will seek re-election in 2024. He promised to make a public announcement early in 2023. Diane Roberts, VOA News.
Today is Monday, November 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinua Dwofo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, U.S. Defense Chief accuses Russia of promoting a world of, quote, tyranny and turmoil as shells slam into Ukraine's nuclear plant.
Putin's fellow autocrats are watching, and they could well conclude that getting nuclear weapons would give them a hunting license of their own, and that could drive a dangerous spiral of nuclear proliferation.
UN climate conference ends in Egypt with the creation of a, quote, loss and damage fund, unquote.
With an agreement to establish a loss and damage fund to help the world's most vulnerable communities prepare for and recover from climate change-related disasters.
And Qatar's first ever World Cup match ends in dismay after falling to Ecuador 2-0. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Ukraine's Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, which is under Russian control, was rocked by shelling on Sunday, drawing condemnation from the head of the UN nuclear watchdog, who said such attacks risk a major nuclear disaster. The International Atomic Energy Agency said more than a dozen blasts shook the Zaporizhzhia plant, which Russia took control of shortly after its February invasion of Ukraine. Russia's defense ministry spokesman said the Ukraine fired shells at power lines supplying the plant. Ukrainian officials did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Both Kyiv and Moscow have accused each other of attacking the plant and risking a nuclear accident. In a speech to a security forum in Canada, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said Russia's invasion of Ukraine has offered a preview of a, quote, possible world of tyranny and turmoil, unquote. His remarks come as residents begin to return to newly liberated Kherson, and Tamara Lindstrom of Reuters reports.
Greeted with a flurry of national flags and tears, Ukrainians arrived in the newly liberated city of Kherson by train Saturday, the first time in more than 8 months.
Slava Ukraine! Slava Ukraine!
For some, the journey marked a long overdue return home after Ukrainian forces liberated the city from Russian occupation just over a week ago. The big welcome came even as the city remains largely without electricity or running water. After a series of battlefield defeats, Russia is aiming punishing missile strikes at Ukraine's energy infrastructure that could leave millions of civilians exposed to the winter cold.
Boston.
Pentagon officials said Moscow hopes to exhaust Ukraine's missile defenses and buy time to reset its forces.
These are atrocities.
At a security forum in Canada Saturday, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said Russia's invasion of Ukraine has offered a preview of a possible world of tyranny and turmoil.
Putin's fellow autocrats are watching, and they could well conclude that getting nuclear weapons would give them a hunting license of their own, and that could drive a dangerous spiral of nuclear proliferation.
Austin's remarks were some of his strongest to date on the importance to the international community of helping Kyiv prevail after nearly 9 months of war, and they were delivered at what may be an inflection point in the conflict. Austin said Russia was breaking the laws of war.
We've seen schools attacked. We've seen children killed, hospitals bombed, and centers of Ukrainian history and culture reduced to rubble.
Moscow denies that its armed forces deliberately target civilians or civilian infrastructure. The United States and its allies have helped provide arms, intelligence, and training to Ukrainian forces while stopping short of directly intervening in a war against nuclear-armed Russia. Also on Saturday, Britain's new Prime Minister Rishi Sunak made his first visit to Kyiv, pledging continued support and providing a new air defense package to help shoot down Russian drones.
And we are stepping up our support to help you through the cold, hard winter ahead. This includes winter kit for your troops, help for your amazing first responders, and another £16 million of humanitarian assistance for food and shelter.
The need for aid was apparent in Kherson's main square on Friday as hundreds of residents clambered for packages of food and secondhand clothing, bracing for the cold winter ahead.
That's Tamara Lindstrom of Reuters. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris arrived in the Philippines on Sunday for talks aimed at reviving ties with the former U.S. colony, an Asian ally that is central to U.S. efforts to counter China's increasingly assertive policies towards Taiwan. Earlier, Harris announced at the APEC summit that San Francisco will be the host city for next year's Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation meetings. She also met briefly with Chinese President Xi Jinping and repeated the message of maintaining open lines of communication. VOA's White House Bureau Chief Patsy Widas-Kuwara has been covering Harris and brings this report from Bangkok.
Thai Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha, host of the APEC leaders' meeting, handed the Thai Chalom basket, this year's APEC symbol, to U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris. It symbolizes the handover of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Chair from Thailand to the U.S. and the end of the summit in Bangkok.
We have discussed the topics of nuclear weapons at the summit. Thailand, as the APEC host, and myself are concerned about this.
While the leaders are concerned about Russia's threat to use nuclear weapons on Ukraine, as an economic forum, APEC focused on boosting trade and addressing rising inflation, food security, and climate change. Harris announced that San Francisco will be the host city for next year's summit. She said there's no better place to host than California, a state known for economic innovation.
I've made clear, the United States is a proud Pacific power. And we have a vital interest in promoting a region that is open, interconnected, prosperous, secure, and resilient.
Harris met briefly with Chinese President Xi Jinping, repeating the message that Washington and Beijing must maintain open lines of communication to responsibly manage the U.S.-China competition. While many look to China for trade and investment, Washington is the main security provider in the region.
When North Korea misbehaves on a regular basis, or when Taiwanese feel insecure on a regular basis that we can see, or the South China Sea, or you know, various issues in terms of insecurity in the region, the U.S. is the security provider counterbalance. So that pattern is very clear.
Washington's message to Beijing may run counter to Harris' visit this Tuesday to the Philippine island of Palawan, which China would likely see as a rebuke. The Palawan island is in the South China Sea, just 330 kilometers west of the Spratly Islands, claimed entirely by China and partly claimed by Brunei, Malaysia, the Philippines, Taiwan, and Vietnam. Harris also met with Thai King Maha Vajiralongkorn and visited a Buddhist temple before leaving Thailand on Sunday for the Philippines. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News, Bangkok.
Thank you, Patsy. U.S. officials are defending their court filing recommending that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman be considered immune from prosecution in a lawsuit over his role in the killing of U.S. residents and Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi. VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sen reports.
The U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is once again in the spotlight after the Biden administration recommended that a Washington court consider him immune from prosecution in a civil lawsuit brought in the United States by Hatice Cengiz, fiancé of slain columnist Jamal Khashoggi, and Democracy for the Arab World Now, the rights group he founded. The 2018 killing in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul of Khashoggi, a royal family insider turned critic, temporarily isolated the crown prince, widely known as MBS, in the West. He has denied that he ordered the killing. Cengiz waited for Khashoggi that day outside the consulate, but he never came out. She took to Twitter to express her disappointment in the U.S. recommendation, saying, "The United States State Department has granted immunity to MBS. It wasn't a decision everyone expected. We thought maybe there would be a light to justice from USA. But again, money came first." State Department Deputy Spokesperson Vedant Patel was asked why the Biden administration weighed in on the lawsuit, and he said it is because the Crown Prince has now been declared Prime Minister.
What this stems from is that Prime Minister bin Salman is immune from suit in U.S. courts while he holds the office of Prime Minister. He is the head of government. It has nothing to do with the merits of this case. The immunity determination is a legal one.
Human rights groups and some U.S. lawmakers also slammed the recommendation for immunity, including Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff from California, saying the United States should take no action to shield those who murder journalists, let alone those who kill and dismember residents of our country. President Joe Biden has also been criticized for his visit to Saudi Arabia in July, after he had vowed during his campaign to make Crown Prince Mohammed a pariah. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
And as the community reacts to the killing of five people at a gay club in Colorado Springs, President Biden has spoken out against the attack. Associated Press correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
Family and friends of people who were known to have been at the Club Q nightclub in Colorado Springs say they endured a terrifying wait. One man says he felt safe going there, and the police chief says there hadn't been any problems at Club Q in the past.
Club Q is a safe haven for our LGBTQ citizens.
Chief Adrian Vasquez spoke on KRDO-TV.
Every citizen has the right to feel safe and secure in our city.
Another man spoke of waiting up all night until he saw a female friend's car return home, meaning she was not among the victims. President Biden says places that are supposed to be safe spaces of acceptance and celebration should never be turned into places of terror and violence, which he says comes all too often against the LGBTQ community. Colorado's governor is openly gay. Jared Polis calls the killings sickening. I'm Jackie Quinn.
In other news, Qatar's first ever World Cup match ended in dismay for an overmatched team with a place in unwanted soccer history. The controversial list tournament opened with Qatar getting outplayed in a 2-0 loss to Ecuador in front of 67,372 fans at Al Bayt Stadium. A host team had never lost its opening game in 92 years of soccer's biggest event. The first World Cup in the Middle East is a chance for Qatar to showcase itself to the wider world, but its soccer team couldn't live up to that moment. Ecuador's captain Enner Valencia scored both of his team's goals in the first half. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Junior Duofo in Washington. The UN Climate Conference ended in overtime on Sunday morning with the creation of a loss and damage fund, unquote, which analysts say is a step towards helping the people already suffering the most from climate change. But in settlements crushed by mudslides in Brazil, locals say it will take more than money to avert disaster. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from Shakashim in Egypt with Jan Bocha in Garujá, Brazil.
In 2020, dozens of people were killed as heavy rains triggered a mudslide into this impoverished settlement in Brazil. It took days to dig out the bodies. Families in the area say that unlike the case in years and generations past, the rain is now aggressive, dangerous, and terrifying.
Ainda não estão destruindo tudo, né? Certeza. Esses dias agora deu um pé d'água que foi muito diferente.
Guarujá resident José Hilda Borges Amarante says elders in her community say the rain and the climate is unlike anything they've seen before. On Sunday, the UN Climate Conference in Egypt, COP27, ended after a day and a half of overtime negotiations with an agreement to establish a loss and damage fund to help the world's most vulnerable communities prepare for and recover from climate change-related disasters, with the first official meetings to even discuss where to get the money and how to disperse it, not scheduled until March 2023, though. It does little to help families already on the front lines of climate change, struggling as climate-related disasters increase in frequency and deadliness. While COP27 did not retreat on international goals to limit global warming, officials say it did little to further the achievement of those goals. Here's UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
But let's be clear. Our planet is still in the emergency room. We need to drastically reduce emissions now, and this is an issue this COP did not address. A fund for loss and damage is essential, but it's not an answer if the climate crisis washes a small island state off the map or turns an entire African country to desert.
In Guarujá, Brazil, locals say the problem is threefold. The climate is changing rapidly. people are destroying the environment, and they have no money to recover after a disaster. Climate change alone may not have caused the deadly mudslides, they say, if the mountains had not been stripped of trees and bushes. Acacio Bezerra da Silva is a painter living in a mudslide-ravaged area. Nature is revolting, he adds. For decades of deforestation and the neglect that have already led the world to warm more than 1 degree Celsius, a trend he hopes international negotiators can slow down, because it is already too late to reverse it. For VOA, Heather Murdoch in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, and Jan Boixa in Guarujá, Brazil.
And as the world's largest methane emitter, China's emission mitigation has been under scrutiny. At COP27 in Egypt, new directions of slashing methane in the country were announced. Charmaine Lee reports from Berlin.
Chinese climate envoy Xie Zhenhua said China has drafted an action plan focused on the power sector, agriculture, and urban waste management to mitigate methane, a greenhouse gas more potent than carbon dioxide. Data from the International Energy Agency's Global Methane Tracker show that China is currently the largest emitter, ahead of runner-up India. So far, though, China hasn't joined other nations in vowing to cut global methane emissions by 30% in 2025. Xie said Beijing wants to improve visibility to gather methane data and called China's methods in this regard weak. Marcelo Mina, CEO of the NGO Global Methane Hub, agreed.
The data sometimes is from very basic literature reviews and are not necessarily reconciled with observations. And if that information is not complete, then it will be difficult to really design mitigation options that are credible.
China's most recent data on methane emissions stops before 2014, so scientists have been seeking to fill in the gap. Several studies found that actual emissions might be higher than Beijing's official data. One found that from 2010 to 2015, China's methane emissions related to coal kept going up. The scientist behind it, Scott Miller, assistant professor of environmental health and engineering at Johns Hopkins University, said the amount of methane went up about 1 to 4 million metric tons each year during this period.
At first glance, that may not seem all that unusual, but I think what made the result interesting to us is that China had passed several regulations on coal mine operations, that there was no noticeable decline in China's methane emissions, indicating that these policies did not appear to be having any kind of impact or the impact that they should have had on the country's methane emissions.
As China is still generating over half of its electricity from burning coal, its coal-related methane emissions are as high as the carbon emissions from international shipping. What's more, an energy crisis has driven the nation to further boost its coal supply. A report from the San Francisco-based Global Energy Monitor this year said China emitted an estimated 2.5 million metric tons of methane into the atmosphere from coal mines alone. Closing coal mines wouldn't be enough to cut China's methane emissions, though, as abandoned mines continue producing methane and China lacks a mechanism to seal them. As the United States and China resumed climate talks, Miller said scientific cooperation between the two on monitoring methane emissions could help China's mitigation efforts. Xie Mingli for VOA News, Berlin.
This is Science in a Minute.
Several studies and findings made by spacecraft, rovers, and landers from NASA and other space agencies suggest that some 4.5 billion years ago, Mars had a thick, rich atmosphere and oceans of flowing water on its surface, which could have possibly supported life. A new study published in the journal Science Advances proposes that early in its evolution, the red planet was covered with water, with an average depth of 300 meters. The study, led by researchers at the University of Copenhagen, suggests all of that water came from ice-filled asteroids, which showered the planet for its first 100 million years. Study authors also found that the asteroids brought important biological molecules like amino acids to Mars. Amino acids are one of the important building blocks that make life possible. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Go beyond the daily headlines with VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. Each weekday, join us as we put the latest developments into a global context with stories, interviews, and analysis. Listen online at voanews.com/flashpoint or in your favorite podcast player.
This has been International Edition under Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com. And check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition and our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA, and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In early November, North Korea, formerly known as the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, or DPRK, launched another barrage of missiles, including a surface-to-air missile that landed a mere 57 kilometers from South Korea, formerly known as the Republic of Korea, or ROK. Another of the missiles launched in early November was an intercontinental ballistic missile the DPRK claims is capable of carrying a nuclear warhead. Pyongyang announced that the launches were practice for a quote-unquote merciless attack on ROK and U.S. targets. Speaking at a United Nations Security Council briefing on the DPRK's missile firings, U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, condemned in the strongest possible terms all recent DPRK missile launches since October 27. She noted that the latest test of an intercontinental ballistic missile is particularly concerning. Ambassador Thomas-Greenfield declared that the DPRK's aggressive behavior is more than just advancing the DPRK's unlawful military capabilities and undermining the global nonproliferation regime. This is also about the DPRK trying to purposely raise tensions and stoke fear in its neighbors. In response to the DPRK's aggressive behavior over the past several months, the United States and the ROK have further deepened their cooperation to bolster their shared security. In July, the United States deployed fifth-generation fighter aircraft to the ROK, and in October, the USS Ronald Reagan Carrier Strike Group redeployed to the Sea of Japan after Pyongyang launched a long-range ballistic missile over Japan. The day after the DPRK's early November missile barrage, U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin and ROK Defense Minister Lee Jong-sup met at the Pentagon for the previously scheduled 54th U.S. Republic of Korea Security Consultative Meeting. The U.S. commitment to defending the ROK is ironclad, said Defense Secretary Austin after the meeting. On the peninsula, he noted, we're returning to large-scale exercises to strengthen our combined readiness and our ability to fight tonight, if necessary. We're committed to building on these efforts to strengthen integrated deterrence and to ensure that this alliance continues to bolster security and stability on the Korean Peninsula and throughout the Indo-Pacific. We will confront the challenges of the future the same way that we have for nearly 70 years, Secretary Austin declared, by standing shoulder to shoulder as proud allies.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.